Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and this week's episodes, we're previewing the 2026 World Cup, going through our flops, dark horses, and our projected winners. Plus, we open up the burn book. While over on the paid side, we give our picks for players of the tournament, breakout players of the tournament, and we get into something fun in anything but football. That's all on today's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So, Pete, we're back. What are you drinking? Are you drinking flavoured water, or are you drinking like a seltzer of like a
White Claw? Seltzer?
Yeah, a White Claw. It looked like a White Claw to me.
I mean, it would fit the bill for me, I guess.
We're gradually turning into white girls.
Well, I think I turned into that long ago. White Girl Wasted. Mm-hmm. No, mm-hmm. It is a flavoured water. Not one I've had before. Aqua Libra. Well, I've had them in the house in the last week because we had them, but since before that.
Sure.
Yeah, we're still on that flavoured water hype. I do have three Modelos beside me because it's, you know, you can see it just in the bottom corner. So we've got a real selection for this evening. It's been a pretty long day, Patrick. I don't know about you, but yeah. Day start before 7 now and roll in from the office at about 10 to 7 p.m. And we start recording. This is now 7:30.
Yeah.
And we were online just after 7:25, and we do the tonight actually quite short 10-minute shit talk off.
Yeah, I think like that bedtime ends now at like about 7.
Mm.
Then between 7 and 7:20, it's like wolf something down. 7:20, I run up to put Coco down because we give her like 20 minutes to kind of wind down and amuse herself before bed, you know, and then roll straight in here and we're shooting. So it's a compressed schedule, I would say, on a shoot day.
I eat dinner after like...
That's crazy.
Half 10, 11?
I would just go to bed.
Yeah, but it's just like...
You're in the fucking Mediterranean now, my friend.
If I get in at, you know, 6:50, in the house, 6:50, and we are due to record 7:30, it's just, or 7:20, it's just tough to get something going and set up and get on. And even the way... And I actually don't eat. I just set up and kind of get myself ready. And I'm still late every single week by like probably 5. I work off like GMT plus 5.
It feels plus, like you work 5, off 10. Me plus 5. Because some weeks I'm like, Pete will be late. So I've got time to get a drink, like... have a piss, dick around, like trudge upstairs and I'm like, oh shit. Oh, I'm like 8 minutes late. Pete will probably be there. Go in. Absolutely not.
Yeah,
you're always at a slight delay.
Yeah, I feel if you add even the quickest of meals in there, it won't be good for our professional relationship.
Our professional relationship is invincible, Pete. It's impervious to damage, I think.
I think it
our
is
personal
quite...
relationship.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I do actually think I actually haven't thought about this until just right now. But we've done, but this is now our second World Cup, which is crazy. I look back when we were doing prep for this app and kind of discussing this week what we would talk about and how we would preview it, etc. I had a look back at what we did in 2022, which was season 1, episode 5, which is our World Cup, our Qatar World Cup prediction. So I guess that was a winter World Cup, so it is a bit, it's not exactly 4 years, but I think it's quite impressive that in 4 years of this podcast, I don't remember a time professionally where we've ever had like beef or issues. We've always just been like,
no,
what do you want to record about this week? And then we discuss it and be like, you'd be like, I don't think that's strong enough. We'd find a topic, then we'd be like, cool, record, fine. Always delivered on time as well. Always published on time. Barring like, I think we missed one because it was death in my family. I think that's the only time you've had to put up like a disclaimer being like, sorry, the podcast not going out this week. And then the biggest issue we've ever had is we've had to re-record half an episode because we just...
Because I said too much actionable shit.
About corporations that used to employ you.
Yeah. A corporation, let's call it Land.
Sea, Land, Sea.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, we've... I was just looking this up while you were talking and we've had... We've been through 6 permanent Chelsea managers in the course of this podcast. 10 if you include interims, yeah. So we've gone, like when we started, Tuchel was the manager.
That's and crazy.
Tuchel, Potter, then we have Bruno Sautor, Frank Lampard, don't count them. Mauricio Pochettino, Enzo Maresca, Callum McFarlane, Liam Rossini, Callum McFarlane again, and now Xabi Alonso.
It's absolutely crazy. I was on... I was on audio boom the other day, and for the first time in like literally ages, just to, for like a potter about. But this podcast has been going for 1,366 days.
Wow.
Averaging 135 listens a day across that period.
That's pretty solid.
It's not
that
bad.
Feels pretty solid.
For such a long period of time, because obviously you have peaks and troughs, and I'm pretty sure in season one we took like a 2.5 month break in summer. Because it was, it was a World Cup year, but the World Cup was in the winter, and we didn't have like annual payments then. Like nobody had like an annual subscription; it was just monthly. So we just paused everybody's, I think, payment for 2 months, and then came back.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, but since then, every summer we're slaving away creating mediocre level content.
Yeah, exactly. Like producing some content.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, when we started, I mean, I don't know who would be the craziest example. You know, of what's happened. I suppose that there are guys like, you know, you take someone like Lamine Yamal is now one of the best players in the world. When we started the podcast, 15? Lamine Yamal was 15. And I think Desiree Doué must have been like 16. And now he's won 2 Champions Leagues. Like,
yeah.
Like that's where we are. So that's quite remarkable. Yeah, it's been an interesting few years. But yeah, our second World Cup. And obviously today we are going to talk about the World Cup because it's been hard to focus on it when in the foreground there's been the Premier League and Champions League waiting to finish. And now they finished, and I think the season was just like interminable. You know, I enjoyed it, but also I enjoyed stages of it, but it kind of never ended. It felt just like it was going to go on forever. And now, interestingly, like we're set up for a very intriguing next season, I think, with like basically all of the top clubs changing manager.
Yeah.
Bar Arsenal. And, you know, yeah, Chelsea finished 10th, but now they've got no European football. Liverpool had some weaknesses in the squad, but they've made a really good managerial appointment. You know, it's even Spurs, like, are doing quite interesting stuff in the transfer market. So I think that when we come to preview next season, it'll be quite exciting and actually quite difficult to predict.
Yeah. And I already got some moves as well, like Gordon to Barcelona, Ederson got the here we go to United.
Yeah.
Like there's stuff happening already. So I think the landscape of next season is going to be quite different to what we saw this season. Just in terms of components, there's going to be loads to discuss.
Yeah, some teams it looks like they're trying to get their business done. Like Bayern seem like they're going to try and get as much of their business done before the World Cup as possible. Like bringing a winger, bringing a fullback, like ready to go. But yeah, today we're talking about teams on this side and then players on the paid side. Before we get into that, I do just want to plug something, which is during the World Cup, I'm going to have a private group chat for people who donate to my charity walk in India next year. So you have to donate 50 quid plus. The link could be found on my Instagram page, on my Twitter page. And if you donate £50 plus and you DM me, then I'll add your number to the group. And I'm hoping that there'll be a few of us in there who can then talk about the tournament, discuss the games. You can ask anything you want. Like we can all discuss things like transfers, managers, obviously the games that are going on, and anything else too. I think it'd be quite a fun place to get into World Cup chat. And yeah, you'd also be supporting my charity walk as well. So I'll try and put a link in the description, but otherwise it's available on my social media. Okay, that out the way. Over on this side, we're going to cover flops, dark horses, and our projected winners for the World Cup. Shall we start with flops?
Ooh, starting spicy.
And I think, okay, I've been very surprised to see the betting markets and also to see what people think is going to happen. Because the team that I've picked for flop, and also that you have picked for flop, we've picked the same team.
Oh, we picked the same team?
I think
nice.
So.
I love it when this happens.
They've been tipped by a lot of people to win. A lot of people. People are coming out of the woodwork all over the place and saying, oh, well, obviously they're going to win. And I'm like, well, firstly, I think they're... Even if you're optimistic about them, there are like 5 or 6 more talented teams at the World Cup.
Yeah.
But my issues run deeper than that.
Oh,
so,
for sure.
So the team I've picked as my flop is Brazil. I am concerned about Brazil. Very concerned. Because you look... Okay, so the first thing to say is that when you look at the teams qualify for the World Cup, Spain, better squad than Brazil. Argentina, better squad than Brazil, I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
France, clearly a better squad than Brazil. England, clearly a better squad than Brazil. Then we get into more debatable ones, but I would say Portugal, better squad than Brazil.
I'd say Germany as well.
Germany, I guess, is a bit more debatable, but Germany, yeah, probably like the strength across the team. Yeah, I would say so as well. And yet, I have seen people predicting Brazil to win the tournament. This is just on social media, so, you know, take it with a pinch of salt, but still. I've seen people predicting Brazil to win the tournament more than I've seen them predict any other team to win the tournament. And I am baffled by it. Baffled by, yeah, honestly, like, I'm looking at this Germany squad now, and you're like, you could play, like, Schlotterbeck, Tah, Rüdiger, Nathaniel Brown.
I think,
like,
there's a load of functional players in that Germany squad to make a decent team.
They put Pascal Gross in as a defender. I would not consider that. Yeah, I mean, they can literally play... I again, would not play Pavlovic Kimmich as a midfield pair. I'd put Stiller in there as well. But, like, you look around and you think, Lennart Kahr, Kai Havertz, Florian Wirtz, Jamal Musiala. Like, I mean, this is a good... This is a good team.
Yeah.
That they can play. I'm not that excited about Germany.
No,
either.
Neither am I.
They've got an excellent coach. They've got a better coach than they've had before.
But Brazil have an excellent coach too. I think that's one of the few things going
for
them.
They do.
But on the balance of squad quality, Brazil, I think Germany's a better squad than Brazil. I have huge issues with Brazil. And I think a lot of people are tipping them, or a lot of people are drawn to them, just because of the allure that Brazil has as a nation, like the historic allure it has as a nation, when they're not actually assessing where the squad is and the significant issues that it has within it. Like, even before, obviously, Ancelotti wasn't there during qualification, pre-Ancelotti, but qualifying was a disaster. They had 8 wins, 4 draws, 6 losses, 44% win rate, worst Brazil qualifying performance in history, or like the modern round robin history. I think, had they not expanded the tournament to 48 teams, Brazil would have had to go through the playoffs, which is unheard of. That was the first warning signs of a squad that a nation that was previously a giant in World Cups and a giant footballing nation being in a really strange, difficult and underwhelming period in terms of their squad.
But in theory, they've had the best coach that they've had in years.
Yes.
You know, and they've got a coach. And I think this is what I'm saying here is what I think other people are thinking, right? They're thinking, okay, yes, there might be some question marks there, but they've got the best coach that they've had in years. And they've got a coach as well who has got a track record of making it work with imperfect talent, you know, finding a way to get the best out of them. But the problem is, I don't really feel like he's put himself in a strong position to do that with the squad that he's picked. Especially the fullbacks are exceptionally weak. Exceptionally weak. So on the left, they've got Alexandro, who's now 35, and Douglas Santos, who's 32 and plays for Zenit.
Yeah.
On the right,
it's an old squad generally.
On the right, they've got Vesely, who's pretty good, who's 22, the guy who's at Roma. But they've got Danilo, who's 34. The centre-backs are fine. You know, the centre-backs, it's like Gabriel Marquinhos.
Yeah, that's fine.
But then you look at midfield and you're like, okay, Bruno G, cool. But next to him, it's probably going to be...
Casemiro. Who runs in treacle.
And then you look at what's happened in front of that as well. So they played quite a bit of 4-2-2-2, right, recently.
Mm.
And they were playing Rodrigo and Estevao. They were playing Rodrigo and Estevao on the wings and then playing Vinny in the front line.
Yeah, it's essentially a 4-2-4.
And Rodrigo and Estevao both injured as well. They're out of the World Cup. So they've got to replace those two players. They've got to cover defensively for Vinny, who's going to do nothing, right? They've also got to cover defensively for Casemiro, who's going to try but is no longer capable of getting around.
Yeah.
And they've got very weak fullbacks. Mm-hmm. So when I look at this team, I'm just like, Gabriel Marquinhos and Bruno Guimarães are going to have a very busy summer. Like, that is what I think when I look at it. And there are some players who can help them defensively and are good and are players who should start, right? So like Rafinha. Rafinha should be starting for them. Rafinha is also an excellent defensive player. Okay, that's fine. But they're talking about trying to get Neymar in. Like, they're still talking about how we can get Neymar in. Like, Ancelotti's like, obviously Neymar's going. Doesn't matter if he misses the first game. Got to have Neymar in the squad. Don't know about that. And then maybe, like, Martinelli is a very good defensive player, but... And I guess what you... Basically, Ancelotti's got to probably work out a system where he has, like, Martinelli defending on the wing when they don't have the ball. But when they do get the ball, Vinicius getting out to the wing and Martinelli replacing him through the middle, right? Like, because that actually kind of works. If you've got a front two and one of them is, like, Igor Thiago and one of them is Martinelli, that's fine. Mm. And then if Martinelli is the one defending on the wing, that's fine too. But I don't see how Vinicius can be in the front two when you're defending and also be on the wing when you want to progress the ball. Because the other thing is, Brazil in the past used their fullbacks a lot to progress the ball. They can't do that anymore because these fullbacks are old and shit. So the plans to progress the ball have to... They also don't have outstanding passing centre-backs. So
Casemiro's a good passer, though, still.
He's not that good. He's never been
amazing. He's not that good, but of those options of...
Bruno G is better than Casemiro as a progressive passer.
But those are your options. You have to go through the centre of the pitch or you go long.
But this is what I'm saying. I think it's like Bruno G has to run the game then. But if I'm another team, I just think, okay, well, we sit someone on Bruno G and we dare them to find another solution.
Or you mean Casemiro play everything with Casemiro.
And it's just and that is just not where you want to be. And I look at like Morocco in their group, and I think Morocco is designed to beat this sort of team.
I kind of feel this too.
Morocco are going to look at Brazil and say, okay, their left wing is obviously their right wing, if Rafinha's there, is dangerous too. But their left wing is the really dangerous area, you know, because you're going to have Vinny out there in some capacity. But we've got Hakimi there. And if we drop someone to play on Bruno and stop them playing through him, they're already going to be down to kind of plan C to progress the ball. So that's fine. You know, like, we'll take that. And they've got someone like Bouadi there, who I think is a really good kind of ground-eating young central midfielder. I'm not saying that, you know, Morocco are going to beat them or Morocco are going to finish above them. But given that I'm looking at them and saying, yeah, I think Morocco could beat them, if I imagine them against France or Spain or England, I just don't see how they get past those teams, you know? Mm. And I think there are so many kind of weak links in what I think will be their starting 11. There are so many problem areas that while they may blitz some teams, I do just think that this is a squad that looks like it's going to get dumped out by a less fancy team at some stage, right?
Yeah, I think the centre-back pairing's fine. We, like you already said that. But I think the formation or the functional formation they'll end up playing, whether they start as a 4-2-2-2, whatever, the way it'll actually play it in the pitch, I think, will not be much closer to 4-2-4, which means that Casemiro will be expected to defend in much more open space and they'll be much more vulnerable in transition just because he can't cover the ground. Bruno G can only do so much in those scenarios.
Yeah.
And you're, like you say, you're not going to progress through wing-backs anymore or full-backs. And even when you look at their attack is, like, Brazil have historically been a top-heavy team. Maybe not to the same degree as some other teams like Argentina, but when you look back at some of the best World Cup performances for Brazil, you think of more attackers than defenders. But when you look at the quality in that attacking arsenal, for me, Vinicius is the only top-class player there. There are other good players. Rafinha is very good. Like, Neymar's done at the top level. Who else have you got? Like, Cunha had a decency. Like,
Bruno G is a pretty... Are you talking just in attack?
Just this attacking stable. Just this front four. Not
the attack is... I don't know.
I think it's good, but I do not
think... Everyone's good.
But what I'm saying is there's only one, like, truly like, good player. I think that's a step down from the Brazil firepower of old. And I think this is... When that's quote-unquote their saving grace, that will paper over a load of these cracks, these issues that Casemiro can't get around the pitch enough to cover them, the holes they'll leave by playing attacking football, their fullbacks are cooked. Their forward arsenal isn't the same as it was when it was like Ronaldinho or Nine era. Like, there isn't, for me, the same depth of top-end quality there. There are good players there. I just feel that against these better squads or more well-rounded squads, if they get into the early knockout stages and get a tricky result or a tricky draw, I can see them kind of being managed out of a game quite easily because teams will set up against them to make it difficult for them to play. They have a limited amount of ways that they can actually play out with the ball and have high percentage of retaining possession. And they will know where to hurt them. They will know that they can... They've kind of got a softish belly with Casemiro and Bruno G there, and that if they come out and play two on the front foot with the attacking players they select in that stable of four players, whether, you know, say it's a slightly more attacking venture of like a 2-4-2 as opposed to a 4-2-2-2, then that leaves them super vulnerable in transition. And I think there are enough smart managers out there with better squads that they can exploit their weaknesses enough to kind of dump them out at like round of 16. And everybody just be like, oh, well, that was kind of a disappointing tournament for Brazil. I also think their group isn't that tasty for them. I think Morocco will be a very tough game. I think Scotland could nick a result against them as well. I mean, Haiti, sure. But I can see them dropping points in the group. And like, we're in a tournament now where you basically need to win one game and not get absolutely pumped in your other games to have a really good chance of going through. So I think, like, they'll, for me, they'll make the knockouts, but I think they'll drop points in the group. I can see them definitely losing one of those games. Not definitely losing, but I wouldn't be surprised if they lost one of those games. And I would personally be surprised if they made it past the round of 16.
Yeah, I agree with all of that, really. I mean, maybe not the Scotland part.
I know, that's like a gut feeling.
But like, you're right about the old squad. You know, because you look around their squad and you're like, there are 8 guys here who are 25 or under, I think.
I think they're the fourth oldest squad in the
There are eight of their outfield players. I mean, if they're outfield players, 8 of them are 25 and under. 8 of them are over 30.
Yeah.
You know?
I think they're a 29 average age.
They've got so few peak players, like peak age players. They've got a couple of 24-year-olds, 3 25-year-olds, a 22-year-old. That's it. Like, nobody, like, I mean, like, even some, Bruno G, I guess, is 28. Okay, Luka and Paquetá are 28. Cunha's 27. So a few guys who are, like, peak age, but not that many. And some of those aren't going to start. And honestly, I'd just feel a lot better if they'd taken, like, Ederson in midfield.
Yeah.
But their midfield choices, they've got Lucas Paquetá, basically a forward. Danilo Santos from Botafogo, 3 caps at age 25. Okay. Fabinho, like the Fabinho we know, who's at Al Ittihad.
Yeah.
Bruno G and Casemiro. He's 32. Those are their fucking midfielders. And I just look at that and I'm like, would it have hurt you to take Ederson instead of Fabinho?
Anybody with a bit of mobility.
I just don't get it. It makes no sense to me at all. And then you could at least play Bruno G, Ederson. Like, if they were going out to this tournament and they were like, right, okay, we're going to play, there's going to be some sort of situation where we're basically going to play like Igor Thiago up front, and then we're going to have Vinny, Rafinha, and either Cunha or Martinelli. Like someone who put a shift in with those guys in that band of three behind the attacker. Like, because that's the thing. They also are going to have to pick, even if I was picking from this squad, doing what I don't think Ancelotti would do, but picking what I think would be the best team from this, I'm going to have to leave out a player who I want to play in order to try and get some defensive solidity in the team. Yeah. You know, like, that's the thing. Like, I don't want to play Cunha and I don't want to play Martinelli really in this team. Like, but I'm going to have to, because those guys are actually going to do shit that the team needs you to do. I don't think he'll do that, though. No, I agree.
Which means they'll be super exposed in transition.
And the thing is, if they go into the first couple of games and they feel more open than they want to be, or, you know, if they have a really bad game against Morocco, which I think it might be game 2 for them. But if they really get a bad game against Morocco, going into the knockout stages, what capacity do they have to change things up?
Yeah.
Like, if Casemiro, Bruno isn't working, I guess they could throw in a third midfielder, throw in like Fabinho or Paquetá. It's not great though, is it?
Like, well, yeah, and then you would just play like a flat three of Thiago, Vinicius, Rafinha.
You lose something in attack, and then you've got somebody like Vinicius actually playing on the wing.
And you've got nobody creating centrally because you've got 3 6/8.
It's no good. Like, and also there's no home for Neymar, and obviously they want to get Neymar in. So I look at this and I just think, this is...
I think there's no home for Neymar generally.
Well, I agree, but like, apparently they want to play him. So this to me just feels like, if I were picking a squad for a tournament, I would want to have maximal optionality, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you get there and it turns out somebody's in bad form and they need a rest, I want to be able to change things up.
The whole point of taking 26 players is that you actually have versatility to be like, to react to scenarios that... Yeah, to maximize your flexibility to react to scenarios.
Yeah, if you look at... I mean, England and Spain are maybe slightly unfair comparisons. Like, England along with France are like, in my opinion, the deepest football nation in the world right now.
I think France are clear, but sure.
They're taking Jed Spence is...
Yeah, I that was crazy.
Is this actually the squad? No. Okay. Yeah, Jed Spence. Is Gerald Kwanzaa going to the World Cup? Is that happening?
Yeah, he's selected.
Okay. Why? Why is that happening? Don't get it. But like, look at England, and you kind of think they should maybe take more than one left back. You know, they're basically taking Nico O'Reilly. And
I mean, you get Jed Spence over there. I know. Like, I disagreed with the Jed Spence selection generally, but yeah.
Miles Lewis-Skelly, Lewis Hall.
Yeah.
Both of them are excellent. Both of them are better than Jed Spence. Both of them, I think, are quite tookily, especially Lewis-Skelly. But, you know, both excellent players. Like, take both of those. And Lewis-Skelly also gives you cover in midfield. But you look at the England midfield, and it's like, I don't love some of these players. I wouldn't have taken Jordan Henderson, for example.
Same.
But you're still like Rice, Anderson, Bellingham, Henderson. Mainoo wouldn't have taken him either. Rodgers.
I would take Mainoo because I think he offers you something different. I don't think he'll play a minute, but I think
he offers you like a overrated player. Morgan Rogers, Eberechiesa. I look at those guys, though, and I'm like, there are so many good combinations that you can make from that midfield.
And they, right? A lot of them offer different things.
Yeah. There are just loads of different things that you can do with those midfielders. Spain, I think Spain have their weaknesses as a squad, right? Like, they're taking Eric Garcia to the World Cup. Like, they're taking 32-year-old Aymeric Laporte to the World Cup. But you look at their midfield and you think Mikel Merino, Fabian Ruiz, Gavi, Dani Olmo, Alex Baena, Rodri, Zubimendi, Pedri.
Pedri, yeah.
I mean, I guess that's the strongest area. But even still, there are so many different ways you can combine this talent and get a functional team out of it. And I look at Brazil and I think there might be one. There might be one team that you can get out of this that would be good. And good enough to win the tournament? No.
No.
Good enough to, like, go out in the quarters. And so I look at it and I'm like, if Brazil make the quarters, that's a good tournament for them, in my opinion. And that's kind of a crazy situation for us to be in with Brazil. But every time I see somebody predict Brazil to win the tournament, I'm like, go with God. Like, I do not see it happening.
No.
Yeah, not good at all. Okay, do you want to go on, unless you have anything else to say about that?
Do you want to go into dark horses? Well, the dark horse I've gone for, I think you may have gone for the same one. I'd be surprised if you didn't. I've gone for Japan.
I've not gone for Japan.
Oh, who have you gone for?
I've gone for Norway.
Okay, that was my second choice. So my thought processes were Japan, and then I flip-flop between Norway and Senegal, who are in the same group. And I think how the group plays out, whoever performs better in that group between those two is like my like secondary dark horse runner.
Yeah, well, I'll come on to the kind of paths for Norway, but I'm intrigued to hear Japan, because actually, I didn't really consider Japan. I mean, though obviously we're talking about Brazil, and Japan did have that like big statement win over them quite recently.
Well, also, like, Japan obviously had that in the 4 years ago. They had a fantastic World Cup. They were in the opposite group of death. They were in a group with Germany and who else was it? Spain. Germany and Spain. Mm-hmm. And they beat both of them in the group.
Oh, yeah.
And then they lost on penalties to Croatia in the round of 16, I think.
Croatia.
But like with Japan, I think this is a really, obviously off the back of the World Cup before in Qatar, this is a really fruitful era of Japanese football. And I think this squad's actually better than the squad that kind of massively overperformed 4 years ago. In terms of how they'll play, like, they're just a very organized, structured, non-egotistical team. Smart, high-tempoed. They're in a group with Netherlands, Sweden, Tunisia. There's a couple of tricky games in there, but international football lacks the high end of like organization and technical, like complicated tactics, basically, just because managers don't have the same amount of time as they have as they do at clubs. And they're kind of, when you have a hodgepodge of club players coming together for a summer, all who play different systems or with different players, different passing sequences that they're super comfortable with, and they then come into a tournament where they need to kind of make accommodations. And these are professional footballers, they can do that, but things kind of don't run quite as smoothly. They're not quite as reflex or second nature as they are at the club, because they don't know exactly where that run is going to be from that winger that they play with who comes from a different country. That's just how kind of international football works, and by as a result it ends up being less technical and less tactically complicated. So for me, one of the greatest kind of kryptonites against that is really highly structured and tactically efficient and evolved team at international level. And I think that really kind of shortens the disparity in individual quality. If a team that is of lower average standard player can come together as a really unified team, and I think Japan really embody that. I think they'll be, like, if you look at their squad, like, the biggest household name there is Takefusi Kubo, and he's a good player, but household name is a bit of a stretch. I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast will know Takefusi Kubo. I think if you go down to your local pub, which is showing football, and ask, do you know who Takefusi Kubo is? I think you won't get that many people who will be able to give you any level of information about him. But if he's your star player, I think the level of ego is quite low. And I think it helps everybody buy into one thing. So we just went through Brazil and their issues. One of the issues was that Vinicius isn't going to defend. You do not get that with a team like Japan. I think Japan are all in, and I think that is a great leveler in a lot of international football. They'll be extremely organised, strong collective mentality. They'll press aggressively as well. They played a really high tempo, which again, I think having a really structured and efficient press is something that is like a truly efficient and good press. Well-organized press is something that is a bit of a rarity at the top level of international football, just because they don't have as much time as you would like to implement it. And yeah, I think this is a golden era for Japan. They obviously absolutely cooked the Asian qualifiers, the first team overall in the entire competition to qualify. They in their six games, they won all, scored 24 and conceded zero. To be fair, the opponents were North Korea, Syria and Myanmar. So you take that with a pinch of salt. But yeah, I think you look down their squad, Ritsu Doan, major attacking threat, striker Koki Ogawa, who I don't think will start. He does have the second best goals per cap ratio in the tournament. He's got 11 goals and 15 appearances, 0.7 a game. The only one better than him, Erling Haaland, with 55 goals in 49 games.
Do you think Goto will start?
Who, sorry?
Goto, because they've got Keisuke Goto, right? Who is this 21-year-old striker who I think was on loan at St. Truiden last year from Anderlecht. So I think he is still an Anderlecht player, but he's 20. Yeah. He'll be 21 when the tournament starts. Or he might be 21. Like, he's 21 today. He's 21 today. But he's like 6'3" and he looks fucking good. Like, he had a pretty good season. Like, first full season, basically, in Belgium. 10 goals in 23 games, which for like a kid in his first full year is like very, very solid at St. Truiden. He's a really interesting little player. But even when you look at, you know, when you look around the squad, there's a ton of experience and quality everywhere. I mean, at the back, they've got a couple of ancient guys, right? Like, they've got...
The Japanese age fantastically.
They've got Nagatomo going, though. He's 39.
Who was the guy who went when... Who's the famous Japanese guy? It's not him, it's the other guy. He was our captain.
He was like 50.
He was like 45.
I feel like they were taking somebody who was like... Yeah. Anyway, I mean, but you look around the squad and you think Sugawara, good player. Tomiyasu, good player. Ito, who's obviously at Bayern Munich, good player. Ao Tanaka, I thought, had a really good season at Leeds. Wataru Endo, who's pretty old now, but good. I mean, Kubo, yeah. Good.
He's fine.
Like Kamada, good. And then in attack, Goto, good. Maeda, good. They've got Ogawa. A bunch of other guys like Ueda, yeah. Ogawa, like all these kind of guys. Like, there's actually quality all through the team. Like, is there any top-end quality? No.
But this is the thing, they don't need it.
But they've got lots and lots of interesting players.
I think Goto will be used primarily as impact off the bench. He's got four caps total. I don't think at this stage he's... And also, because he's 21, he'll be 25 at the next tournament. I think the smart play is that he impacts off the bench, and then his size is actually more beneficial against tired centre-backs.
Yeah.
I think you've got Ueda and Ogawa, who have more experience and are older. I think they're both in their late... They're both peak age players. I think those are the players you'll see vying for starting spots more. But with no superstar, I guess the lack of like superstar finishing is the one concern you have against Japan. But I think this isn't to win the tournament. This is kind of like, for Japan, if Japan get to the quarterfinals, it'd be a fantastic, fantastic tournament.
Even if they just had like Mitoma going, like, yeah, that would be very helpful. Like, that would make it a lot easier to see big upsets in their future. Just having that one extra bit of stardust in attack. Without that, it's hard to see something like truly magical happening. But like, one round further than people expect is totally, totally possible.
I think Netherlands, Sweden, Tunisia, tough group for Japan. But I think their hyper organization.
Everyone's beatable.
But that's the thing. So like, there's no mega team there. There's no France, yeah, there's Spain, there's no England. Yeah. It's like, if you get a win against like the Netherlands, or like if you draw with the Netherlands and you beat Sweden, nobody would be massively surprised. It's not like, oh my God, Japan just... It's not like 2022 when they beat Germany and then Spain, or whichever way around that happened, I can't remember. That was like kind of holy shit moment. I don't think if they pick up points in any of those games, anyone has that reaction. So get out of the group. And then I just think the standard quality within their squad is decent, it's good. And I think their collective, there's some of their parts is better than their as individuals. And I think that at international football is a bit of a leveler for me. I just think their organization and their ability to kind of play as a completely unified team, way more so than probably most other teams, most other good teams we'll see in the tournament. I think that's a real leveler, and I think that could send them kind of a round or two further than you'd expect. I think if they can get to the quarterfinal, it would be amazing. Round of 16, I think it'd be good. Be like, well done, Japan. Good team, good tournament. Quarterfinals, I think, would be really, really a really special year for them.
Yeah, I agree. But anything can happen. You know, you win that group, you're up against a third place team in the next round. Suddenly, the path gets a lot easier for you. So I think it's quite hard to pick dark horses because, you know, like if you say like Portugal,
are they a dark horse?
If you pick them to win, they're dark horses.
Sure, okay.
But win versus go far, you know, there's a big difference between those things. So I thought about Portugal because I was like, I think it can make a good case for them to win because I think that squad is better than Brazil's. I think it's maybe better than Argentina's. Like, it's a really good squad. Mm. Biggest problem for them, Roberto Martinez.
Sure.
Terrible. And also playing Ronaldo up front. You know, like, that is an issue for them as well.
Well,
like,
yeah, they have to pander to him.
Ronaldo's a drag on them at this point. He was a drag on them at the last tournament as well. So that's a bit of an issue. But I thought instead I'd pick a true underdog. So if you look at Elo, which is like, you know, a measurement of team quality, they're ranked 23rd of 48 teams, Norway. So they're below the USA. They're below Iran. They're only four spots above Uzbekistan by this rating.
Mm, that's strange.
I do not think that matches up to the reality of where this Norway team is right now. The attack is ranked 10th. So a tool I used is KU Leuven. So I guess that must be like King's University or whatever, like based in Leuven in Belgium. Like, they have this DTAI sports analytics lab.
They about to say DTF.
So yeah, DTF. So they've got a really fun website where you can look at the group phase, the knockout phase. You can look at different probability of teams like going through versus going out and the probability that they'll finish first, second, third. It's really interesting. And they also have all the teams kind of ranked by offense, defense, ELO. By offense, Norway are 10th. They have Norway 10th. So about the same level as Brazil, England, Germany, Colombia, the Netherlands. Like, the only teams that are ranked definitively ahead of them by attack are Spain, France, Argentina, and weirdly, Senegal. I think that's probably a function of CAF, but, you know, still. So I do think they are better than their ELO rating would suggest and than the average fan would think they are. And they were top scorers in UEFA qualifying by 8 goals. So the second top scorers in qualifying were Belgium with 29. Spain had 21 in their group. France had 16. Erling Haaland had 16 by himself.
Yeah.
England had 22 goals in qualifying. I mean, admittedly, they did not concede a goal in qualifying. But Norway had 37 goals in 8 games. 37. That is nearly 5 goals a game they averaged. And, okay, you can argue it was easy, though I don't know if it was that much easier than a load of the groups that these other teams faced. And they still had Italy and beat them twice. And the attack is not just... The attack obviously has Erling Haaland, so it has the best striker in the world. But then it has Sørloth and Jorgen Strand Larsen is their third striker.
Yeah, it's kind attack. Of insane what they're producing in Norway at the moment.
So they have those three strikers plus Ødegaard and Antonio Nusa. And the attack knows... They all know each other so well. When you watch them play, the way they counterattack in particular is remarkable because Nusa is like the perfect fit for that front line because he's really fast and he's super creative. Like, he's a good dribbler and a good creator. He's an okay shot getter, but where he really excels is as a creator, as a creative winger. And he knows Haaland's movement super well. And they are able to feed these attackers relentlessly. And so if you look at this tool, they've got Norway is having a 72% chance of getting into the second round. I think, again, that their odds are potentially a little better than people think. Because, yeah, they're in a group with France. But I don't know, man. Like, they've still got, I think, a 16% chance to finish top of the group, according to this tool. Mm. A 30% chance to finish second. So basically, like, a 50% chance to finish in the top two places. If they batter Iraq and beat one of France and Senegal, that might be enough to finish top of that group.
Yeah.
And because only three teams go through from each group, this is also a kind of chaos maxing element. If you don't win your group, you're not nailed on to play a team that did win their group in the next round. If you finish third, you'll play a team that finished top of their group. But there are two teams that didn't finish top of their group going through from each round, and obviously one who won their group. So if you're a runner-up, you play a runner-up. So yeah, if you're third, you play a group winner. But if Norway even comes second, they would face the runner-up of Group E. Group E is Germany, the Ivory Coast, Ecuador, and Curaçao.
Mm-hmm.
You look at that if you're Norway and you're like, oh, okay, We could totally do that. And obviously, if you win the group, you place a third place team. But either way, you're saying maybe you get to the round of 16 before you play a really tough team. And if you game out the most likely scenario, which I think, like, let's say second place, let's say France win the group, Norway second place, then you'd be playing probably Ecuador or the Ivory Coast. After that, you'd maybe play Brazil, unless Brazil comes second to Morocco, in which case you play Morocco in the round of 16. And again, I look at both of those teams and I'm like, Norway have quite a good shot against both those teams. Like, Morocco are a great defensive side, but Norway are an amazing attacking side. Brazil, good attack, soft underbelly. Mm-hmm. Norway would love that. Norway would rip through them. And so I look at that and I'm like, yeah, Brazil with crap fullbacks and not enough legs in midfield. And so then I look at it and I'm like, Norway could come second in their group, play like Ivory Coast, then play Brazil, beat them, and then you're in the quarterfinals, and then you'd probably get England. And I think that would be a bridge too far. Like, I can't see Norway getting past England, though I must say, when you've got, if Odegaard's fit, if you've got Odegaard or Haaland, you've always got a chance, right? Like, anything's possible. But that to me would be a bridge too far. But I don't even think...
I mean, it'd be like Odegaard, Haaland versus Konsa Gehi.
Sure, but also against, like, you know, Rice.
Rice Anderson. I get it.
You know, I mean, sure. But but Haaland gives you a chance. You've always got a chance with him. And I don't think you have to squint that much to see a world in which the quarterfinals is possible. Like, when I look at those games, I'm like, Norway should finish second, in my opinion, in this group. It'll be a tough fight between them and Senegal, but they should finish second in this group. And then if they play Ivory Coast or Ecuador, they should beat that team.
Yeah.
And then they're in the quarterfinal. And if they're up against Brazil, then they're in the round of 16, rather. And then if you're up against Brazil or Morocco, I give them a puncher's chance against both teams. Maybe better than a puncher's chance against both teams.
Yeah, I mean, like so that model that you... I've just got on the website. The Senegal have a 36% chance of finishing second and Norway have a 30% chance. But if you look at the game individually, like, Senegal have a 37% chance of beating Norway, 32% chance of tie, 32% chance of... It's super even. Like, that's kind of split three ways, almost.
Yeah.
Like, Senegal slightly edged. But these are prediction models. Like when it's that close, basically, you would say that assuming everybody beats Iraq, that grip comes down to that game and whether anybody gets points off France.
Yeah, and I think Norway are much more likely to blitz Iraq than Senegal
for sure,
are.
Yeah.
I don't know if either one of them will get points off France, but like Senegal could totally beat Norway. And it would still mean Norway going through in third place in Group I, which would mean they'd play, I don't know, like probably somebody pretty decent. But it wouldn't be like disastrous for them. They'd play, I think there's some weird, there are like four options or something. But it'd be winner of Group D, Group G, Group A, or Group L. So D is the USA-Turkey group, which is easy. Group A is Mexico, South Africa, South Korea, or Czech Republic. Totally beatable. Mm. Group G is Belgium, Egypt, Iran, New Zealand. Belgium, also totally beatable. And then Group L is England, Croatia, Ghana, Panama. So England would suck, but anything else there is like a winnable game.
Yeah, but also not every third place team will go through, though there's four that'll drop out.
Yeah, but Norway I think will, because they're such high scorers.
Yeah.
So anyway, like it's like I say, there's obviously nothing guaranteed here, but I would not be surprised. It would, like if in a month's time, a quarterfinal between England and Norway is coming up and it's like, holy shit, Norway knocked out Brazil. Or holy shit, like, you know, Norway knocked out AFCON champions, Morocco, and Norway beat Iraq 8-0 in the group stage. Norway are absolutely fucking flying. Like, and it's suddenly like a relatively scary prospect for them to play, because they start with Iraq as well. So like, they're going to want to try and batter. They've got to win that game, like, obviously. But if they put out a statement win in that match and they play France last, by which point it's dead rubber. Like, who cares? If they get a win against Iraq, they're probably through. If they get a point against Senegal, they might be in second. So I just think it's quite easy to be positive about Norway. And I don't think they're going to, like, win the tournament. I don't think they're going to make the semis. I think if they play one of the truly good teams, Spain, France, England, they'll go out. But I wouldn't be surprised if they really did upset somebody in the course of this tournament. I think they're a lot of fun. So shall we go on to winners?
Winners. Who you got?
I wanted to be fun here.
Yeah. I think it's difficult to be fun with winners because it is like the one section that you're like, you kind of have to go with who you think will actually win the tournament.
I was really tempted to say England. Really tempted.
I just don't see it.
But they've just... The squad is very good. I've got to say, given that... I think England's pool of players is phenomenal. But when I looked at the squad, I was like, the squad doesn't feel as phenomenal as the pool of players does. You know?
Yeah, some of the omissions are quite substantial.
Yeah.
And some of the selections in place of the omissions are quite questionable.
And also, you know, part of what makes the crop of talent in England right now remarkable is that it is so deep everywhere. But obviously that counts for less in the tournament because everybody can only take the same number of players.
Bar maybe centre-back.
So you can't take all your good players. Yeah. And as a result, you know, it doesn't matter that England also have Adam Wharton and he's not going to the World Cup because he's not going to the World Cup. Like, it doesn't matter that their 27th man is much better than the 27th man for another nation because you can't take the 27th man. So I was quite tempted by England. I also think set pieces are probably going to be a big factor at the World Cup. They've got Saka and Rice, who obviously do that at club level. They've got like Dan Burn and a bunch of big motherfuckers like who are going to be there. Like, I think that set pieces could go a long way. They've obviously got an elite coach for the first time ever, which is interesting. The defense was absolutely fucking smothering in qualifying. They've got Harry Kane, who's just had the most insane season of all time. So I was really tempted by England. France are tempting as well, but I don't love the midfield for France. I mean, maybe that's insane. Like, who are they actually going to field? But like, I think they'll play Kante. I think they'll play N'Golo Kante.
Do you think they will?
Yes. And I just hate Didier Deschamps. I just hate him.
Do you think Zaire Emery will play?
Even though I said his name really weirdly. They'll play Rabiot. They'll play like Rabiot and Kante. They'll do mad shit. They always do boring shit. Like, what they should do is just play like Tchouaméni and, I don't know, Zaire Emery.
Yeah.
And someone else. And then they should just be like the most important, like they should play like Doué in there. And then they should say front line is going to be fucking Mateta or anyone up front. Actually, play Dembele up front, play Elise on the right, play Mbappe on the left. Yeah. That'd be fucking nuts. That'd be so good. And Mbappe is a shit presser, but everybody else rocks in that front line. Mm. Man, that would be sick. That would be so good. But they won't do it. They'll be way more boring than that. They just always are. However, I mean, the squad is crazy. The squad is crazy, crazy, crazy.
Yeah.
And when you look at the centre-backs, like, they're going to play the best centre-back in the world plus somebody else. It's going to be Saliba plus somebody else. Tchouaméni is an amazing number six. People forget it because of how he's used at Real Madrid. But there's depth everywhere. However, I don't know why I'm going on about this, because fundamentally, even though I think France are more talented, I think Spain are the best team in the world. And I think Spain are going to win the World Cup.
I agree.
Or if you make me bet on someone, I'm going to bet on Spain. Like, they are just like... They're an amazing attack. They're an amazing defense. The midfield is out of this world.
Yeah.
And so they just control games. Yeah. And controlling games goes a long way. I mean, we'll talk about some other teams when we get onto the paid side and we're talking about players, but their midfield is just impossible to manage.
Yeah. And I think when you look at their spine as well, the players, loads of them are Barca or City or Pep City at some point. Like, Laporte was obviously... under Pep for what, like six seasons? What, 2018 to 2022-ish? Four or five seasons, sure. Whatever. I think when you have that amount of players who play week in, week out with like astronomically high possession, running through the spine of your team, like Barca were touching 70% possession the season just gone. City were 61%, I think, possession, average possession across the Premier League season that just finished. When your entire spine of outfield players plays week in, week out for teams that dominant and that kind of ball heavy, I think it lends itself really easily to them just kind of having control possession and controlling games and smothering smaller teams and just making teams feel like they just cannot get into the game at all. And they'll just have such control over games that they'll then feed into incredible wingers like Lamal, Nico Williams, who are astronomical 1v1 threats. They'll look to kind of manipulate and manufacture them, getting them on the ball in kind of space and creating isolations all over the pitch. If you are, kind of on each of their respective wings, if you are a defender and you're having to defend in space against one of Lamal or Nico Williams, it's going to be a tough night for you. It's going to be a tough night. Yeah.
And they're really good at getting them in that space.
And they're also super high volume take on the carries. Yamal's super dangerous from cutting inside for shots. Williams kind of more aggressive on the outside with kind of creation from the left flank. But they're very, very good at a lot of things. But when you look at the kind of type archetype of player, they're going to do a few things a lot. And if they can get you as a wing back or fullback isolated, you're in for a super long night. And then you've just got like Cucurella, Grimaldo, like players who are good players who are like third tier players in this list of squad players that we're going to go through. You know, like they're fullbacks and wingbacks that can actually add a lot to how they play in the pitch, but are so far down the list of like who is a superstar in this list. They're like, we spoke about Brazil having like absolutely cooked fullbacks. These guys are in the same kind of level of notoriety within their own squads, but they're astronomically better as players, and they're better ages. They are more attacking and more influential on the pitch, even with all these superstars around them. I also like the blend of ages as well. They do have a lot of youth. They've got good kind of peak age players. Peak to post-peak, I guess, seniority. I guess Rodri is post-peak now. I guess Laporte's pretty old. Don't love that, but they do bring experience. But then Pedri, Nico Williams, both under 23. Yamal, Kabarsi, Gavi, all under 21. Fifth youngest squad in the tournament. So I think it's a nice blend. Basically, it ticks all the boxes I like to see of a squad composition, squad talent, squad kind of balance within who they can play, what they can do, how they can manipulate and manufacture the team in different ways to react to different scenarios, and just general overall individual quality is across the board just fantastic. Do I think they're slam dunk to absolutely win the tournament? No, this is knockout football. Lots of things can happen. If you look at Opta's supercomputer, like they only have a 16% chance based on Opta's supercomputer to win the tournament. That's pretty low. I mean, it's high considering that a ball hasn't been kicked. But like, if you're looking at the top three, it's France, England, it's Spain, France, England. 16%, 13%, 11%. So we are talking really small margins here, but I do think that it's the best combination of complete squad, good individual talent, least notable weaknesses, and best control. And I think control overall will come into across the tournament, like the amount that a team will be able to control scenarios and control the variables that they want to control. I think that does over time end up being one of the most determining factors of how far you go. I don't think France and England can control games the way that Spain can, and I think that'll be the difference.
I think I don't know. I mean, the thing is, we just don't know.
This is a prediction.
I doubt that France can. I think there's a possibility England can. Like if England ended up against Spain in a final, I think it's totally possible.
I mean, they lost.
Sure, but this is a different England team. Like, I think it's totally possible that this England team would be able to, like, press them out of a game. I do think that's possible.
Do you think?
Yeah, it's possible. Why not?
Rodri in midfield, Kabarsi at centre-back.
I mean, Rodri can't move anymore. Like, it's possible. It's totally possible.
That midfield's so good as well.
That midfield is really good. But, like, it's more flawed than it used to be, though, right? As in, there are always injuries in there, especially if you don't have Yamal as a bit of a pressure valve as well, then that doesn't help things. Rodri is also just not the player he was. Like, so those sorts of things make a difference too. However, like, I agree. Like, I do think this is like, it's kind of like you said about Japan. Nobody at the elite level, nobody in the World Cup is going to be pressing at an elite level, right? It's just not going to happen. And so that's really favorable situation for the teams who can control the ball in midfield, because the only team that's likely to press at an elite level is England. Like, that's the most likely team.
I think Japan's press will be very good.
It won't, but they won't
but,
be that
but the individual
won't
players
be good
will
enough
be...
for Spain.
Sure. Yeah.
England's the one team that has like the legs, the physicality to press absolutely everybody, and then also has quality on the ball. Like that they're the one team who could do it. And we don't know if they'll do it. So I look at them. I mean, Argentina pressed really aggressively in the last World Cup, and they've actually got a really, really good midfield. They do, but not really a particularly good ball winning midfield. So if they can get the ball, great. But if they can't, then they're in trouble.
But that's kind of Argentina in a nutshell, though, right? Just generally top heavy, great on the ball. What are you going to do?
I think that's less true now than it used to be.
It is less true now, but it is still does still carry some truth.
Yeah, but I just think that this is the best team in the tournament. They're the most complete team. Yeah. When we've seen them play in the past, they look like a club team.
Yeah. It's really impressive.
They just look really, really good. So, yeah, I mean, those are our takes. And obviously, we'll talk about some players over on the paid side. But it's a pretty juicy tournament. Like, there are loads of teams in it that I think are legit good. And lots of potential surprises to be sprung. But, yeah, if I look at the Leuven tool, I think they're giving Spain a 35% chance of making the final and a 24% chance of being champions.
So that's 10% greater than Opta's.
I mean, I think these are crazy because they've 25. Got England at like 7% to be champions, and I think that isn't bananas low. England at 7% to win the tournament, and the Netherlands at 4%. Portugal at 3% below Colombia.
Yeah.
Get the fuck out of here. Like, to me, that's like when you over-index on Elo.
Yeah, and also I think the K11 model has Spain winning it against Argentina in the final, Argentina beating England in the semis. I think if Argentina and England meet in the semis, I think England roll them over.
And Spain-France in the other semi. Like, complete toss-up. Because I don't love Spain's defenders defensively, you know? I like a lot of them on the ball, but do I want Cucurella and Kubasi defending Olise and Ousmane Dembele? No. And also, the other thing is, Yamal might spend some time injured, right?
I guess you'll rest him in the last group.
But he's injured right now. They think he'll be back in time, but he's injured right now, and it's a question as to the condition he comes back in.
Or he just doesn't play in the group.
Sure, which will be fine. It won't make any difference.
Yeah.
But if you look at Spain's depth in attack, it's not amazing. So if Yamal doesn't play, then next up is going to be, like, these are their attackers. Ferran Torres, Jeremy Pino, Nico Williams, Lamine Yamal, Mikel Oyarzabal, Borja Iglesias, and Victor Muñoz. Those are their attackers. They've also played Marino in an advanced role before.
Yeah.
And Dani Olmo and Alex Baena, I guess, you know,
Williams is good.
Those are more attacker type. Yeah, but Nico Williams is going to be playing anyway.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if Yamal misses a game, if Yamal isn't fit...
Who's his replacement?
Whereas France...
Yeah.
Like, France...
Like, France can roll out two teams that will make the knockouts and be competitive.
France, let's say France's first string attack is Olise, Mbappe, Dembele. The backups are Shirky, Akliouche, Marcus Thuram, Bradley Barcola, Désiré Doué, and Jean-Philippe Mateta.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That is fucking insane.
Theoretically, France should kind of win all of these tournaments based on the depth of their squad, but also France are their own worst enemy.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
And I just don't think that they have the control needed. They have astronomical levels of individual talent. I just don't think they can control games in any way that we would see Spain do it, England as well to an extent. And I think that's what matters when you get into the real business end of tournaments.
Sure. It's fucking mental that England didn't take Cole Palmer, you know.
I know
he hasn't had a good season, but fucking hell, Cole Palmer not going to the World Cup is funny as fuck.
But Jed Spence is.
No Cole Palmer, no Adam Wharton, even no Phil Foden is hilarious to me. Those three players would make any other squad except for maybe France.
And also, like, there's literally 26 players on the plane. If they give you 40 good minutes off the bench, it's better than some of the players you've selected, who will give you nothing.
Yeah, like, I think it's okay to take Tony because you need another kind of forward. I mean, I guess Rashford had a good season, but Rashford had a good season.
I think
at
Rashford
Barcelona.
Could start on the left for them.
But Henderson,
I think Tuchel might start Rashford.
Obviously, you bin Henderson for Wharton.
Why was
easy
Henderson
move?
Selected?
Easy move. He loves Morgan Rodgers.
Had a good
Bellingham,
season.
Bellingham, Ezra, and Rodgers in there.
Yeah,
does feel a bit like overkill.
Yeah. Unless you're going to play Ezra for left.
Instead just look at that defence and I'm just like, you know what? If you drop Dan Burn out of this defence...
He does give you...
That'll be fine. Yeah, but you've got Kwanzaa, who's a centre-back. You've got Gehi, Stones, Kwanzaa. You've got loads of shit there.
Yeah.
Fuck it. I'd play Rice centre-back before I like...
To
get Palmer into the squad, yes. Palmer is like an actually magical player. To be honest as well, I'd fuck one of these guys off and be like, let's just take Colwell. Or take Lewis Skelly and don't take Henderson. Like, take Lewis Skelly, don't take Henderson. I mean, Jed Spence, I guess the argument is he covers both sides. But take Lewis Skelly, don't take Henderson.
Yeah, but he covers both sides poorly.
But yeah, you could drop Dan Burns, and Henderson, and then you could just take Lewis Skelly to cover those positions, and then you could put in Cole Palmer.
Yeah.
And I don't think that hurts you. I think you'd be fine.
Like, with 26 players, there's going to be like, you could have five of those players don't play a single minute. I don't understand why you would take some of the players.
Everyone will play some minutes. Everyone will play minutes.
But you could play zero. Five of those players could play 0 minutes and it wouldn't really affect legs.
This backline selection, I think, is insane.
Yeah.
You're taking John Stones. Okay.
Yeah.
I guess it's like, if he's fit, then great.
I don't mind John Stones as much as Jed Spence.
But it's like a classic, if he's fit, then great. Yeah, but he won't be fit. Half of these guys are so injury prone, man. Like Stones, Tino Livramento, Reece James. These guys are all fucked.
Yeah.
Whatever, man. Interesting. Fucking Barcelona forward, Anthony Gordon. Sure. Whatever. Look, England can do whatever they want. I don't give a shit. Okay, well, those are our predictions for the World Cup. Should we go on to the burn book? Okay, burn book time. What am I? I'm going to put something in the burn book to start us off.
Cool.
I'm concerned that the days of going to warm parts of Southern Europe are like at an end. I'm concerned that those days may be gone.
Becoming unbearable?
Yeah. Because I was in Paris last week during the heat wave and it was 34, 35 degrees in Paris. And actually, there was a record high in the UK as well for May. It was 35 degrees. It hit, by the way, that record was set about a mile from my house. And even when I worked with a couple of Texans, and when I told them the temperature it was, even they were shocked. I was like, it's 35 degrees centigrade in the UK in May.
Took them 15 minutes to figure it out, yeah.
Yeah, I had to do it for them. But I was like, that's 95 degrees Fahrenheit. And they were like, what? In the UK? Like, in May? And I was like, yeah, this is where we are now. And Emma and I have been talking about holidays, you know, like next year and how we're basically going to do holidays with the kids. And now I'm kind of like, if you want to go somewhere like Sevilla, you know, a place we both like.
Let's say
Florence, for an example.
Sure. Yeah.
When we went to Florence, I think in June, this was in 2022, it was like 37 degrees. And that's not, it gets hot, obviously, but it's not like a famously hot place.
Yeah.
37 degrees. And you think, and this is becoming the norm basically everywhere. And when we were kids, you know, obviously people would kind of go off to Greece or Turkey or the south of Spain or, you know, the Balearic Islands or the Canary Islands or whatever. Like, people, these are all places people would go for their summer holidays. I wonder if the future is not that. I wonder if the future is that people start going north in peak season, or going to Scandinavia, or going to the lakes, or going to, like, you know, out of season ski resort type places, you know. I wonder if that is going to start being the norm, because you going on holiday to look for the sun no longer makes sense when you have insane sun at home, and when the sun in those places is not 30 degrees or 27 degrees but 40 degrees.
Yeah.
And that's becoming the norm now. Like to have a heat wave in Paris and London that is 35 degrees in May is just like, I don't know, it kind of beggars belief, makes you a bit fearful for what it's going to be like in July. I will say, when this happens, there are always like dickheads who are like, I'm in Florida and I'm telling you that's not hot at all. And it's just like, yeah, but you live in a fucking stupid place. Like, you live in a fucking shithole, so shut the fuck up. Like, oh, I'm actually living on the surface of the sun right now and it's way hotter than that. It's like, all right, dildo, like, no one cares. It's still really hot. On the other hand, you get a load of like English and French people being like, no, what you don't realize is our houses are not built for the heat and we don't have aircon everywhere and stuff. And it's like, it's been going this way for a while now. If you don't own an aircon unit at this point, that is on you. You can buy an aircon unit. I was like, this is unlivable. So I bought an aircon unit.
Yeah, same.
You know, and...
But we can't help the fact that our houses are built to retain heat. It makes it much harder.
Effectively they retain heat.
I don't know. This loft hits 40 degrees in
That's the issue. I think London is a special case, especially central London. Because there's heat from underneath as well.
The heat inertia generally. Yeah.
There's heat from the tube, like literally in the ground. The ground is hot. Obviously, the buildings are like metal and glass. Like, there's loads of reflected heat. There's a load of pollution, which traps the heat in. Like, all that kind of shit. But, like, in your house, I live in a part of London with the river on one side and the biggest park in London on the other side. And my house still gets roasting hot. And I bought an aircon unit. So I do think, look, if you can't afford an aircon unit, that's fair enough. Like, that's a reasonable problem to have. But a load of people could afford an aircon unit and they're still bitching about how fucking hot it is and how we don't have aircon. Buy an aircon unit. However, it's undeniable that you go into your office and your office doesn't have aircon. You know, you're on the tube and the tube doesn't have aircon. Like the trains, the buses, like loads of places are just stinking hot and nobody has adapted to this. It is a nightmare. And so, yeah, I'm just a bit concerned that like from now on, when it comes to the summer, people won't say, oh yeah, we're going to, you know, Spain or Italy or basically anywhere south of the UK anymore. They'll say we're going to Norway.
I think northern France stays pretty stable. We have the house out.
Can do.
Kind of,
yeah.
We have the house out kind of 2 hours inland of Bordeaux. So not like super, super south, but south enough in France. But even last summer when we took the baby out, we were touching like 35, 36 in the house overnight. And obviously like, I don't know if mum's bought an aircon unit for this year, but like trying to control heat inside when the outside in the day is like 36 is quite difficult. And then it stays really close heat throughout the night. And you have a baby in a cot in a nappy and nothing else at 36 degrees heat overnight until like 4 or 5 a.m. when it kind of slightly breaks and gets down low enough that you can open the windows for colder air to come in. She slept fine, but it was a concern and it was a challenge. And that's not even that south or notably that warm of an area. Like it's not like Seville. It's not a famously warm area. That's just the standard now. So I think we'll be back there next month, probably about 6 weeks, 5-6 weeks. And I'm interested to see, one, if mum's bought an aircon unit, two, if it's gotten a degree or two worse. And I guess it's hard to categorically say it is now 1 degree hotter than it was last year because it's all just weather dependent. But yeah, it was hot last year and it's the first, we've had the house for like 4 years, four or five years. And maybe it was just because I was hyper aware because we had the baby this time. But I was like, fucking hell, it's really warm in this house now, overnight.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. I think we're all going to have to kind of change our habits or change our understanding of what we should be doing. What about you? What are you putting in the burn book?
What I'm going to put in the burn book this week is the AP Swatch Royal Pop. Are you familiar with what the Royal Pop is?
I am.
So Swatch and AP collabbed on a watch, well, I'll put watch in inverted commas, recently, and people kind of lost their shit about it. People were camping out for days in front of the Swatch shops across the world to get one, and it represents basically everything I hate about the luxury watch ecosystem. Like, I don't like APs generally. Hate Royal Oaks. Always have. I don't think there's a bigger try-hard watch out there than the Royal Oak. You know, it's one of the watches that you buy just to show people that you can buy it. It's like the Lamborghini Urus of watches. And like,
yeah, though I would say that Lamborghini, I don't know, whatever, let's not get sidetracked.
Well, things like Lamborghini Uruses are basically already RSQ8s, but three times the price. The build of them is basically the same, but with a different body.
Yeah, but that's batch. Not my issue. I mean, it's like when I'm thinking about the showiness of it, I'm like, that is the Lamborghini DNA. And I think you buy a Lamborghini knowing that you're like a flash cunt.
I think that's exactly why you buy an AP. I don't think they think they are though.
I think those people buy those watches thinking that they're being really classy.
I fully disagree.
I think they're like Essex boys who think it's like super.
I think
classy.
They're Essex boys who and they want can't to tell show the they can spend 20 grand on a watch.
Sure, but I also think I think that they think it's like it's hard to explain the difference here. I think that somebody who buys a Lamborghini knows the difference between buying a Lamborghini and like an Aston Martin. And they are making an intentional decision to go for the Lamborghini because they like and enjoy the bad taste elements of owning a Lamborghini. And I think the people who buy APs don't think it's bad taste.
I don't think the people who buy Lamborghinis think it's bad taste. I think they're one and the same. I think they're one and the same, making conscious decisions to be overly flashy to show how much people they don't know how much money they have.
Put it this way.
In a very, very visible way.
I would happily have a Lamborghini, but I would not buy an AP.
That's kind of crazy. You'd happily have a Lamborghini. Wait.
Yeah, because Lamborghinis are silly and like, like there is an element of a...
You need to learn to drive first.
There's this Italian like fashion guy I follow on Instagram. And he always uses the word like fantasia. And like they translate it in a bunch of different ways, but obviously what he means is like a kind of playfulness. And to me, like the Lamborghini is just like any Lamborghini makes you feel like a 12-year-old with a picture of a car on your bedroom wall. That is what Lamborghinis are for. So from that point of view, I can imagine having a Lamborghini and being like, it's the car I wanted when I was fucking 12.
Seven, yeah.
And it fucking rocks.
This is silly, yeah.
Whereas an AP, I'd be like, this is the watch I'd want if I'd maybe been born and stayed in Kent. You know, like it's that I don't know better.
Yeah,
is kind of how I feel. I mean, this is really, really cunty behavior. But like, basically, it's all like chavs and chav nots, like, is what we're talking about. But
basically, AP represent everything I don't like in watches or in the watch market.
And that's kind of why I love. Okay, so I kind of love this fucking Swatch thing.
No, I fucking hate it. So
no, but I like it that all these like fucking knobs are pissed off by it. I've seen so many boring menseswear guys I know. I'm not including you in this. I've seen so many boring menswear guys I know making a big performance of how much they hate it. Like posting it and being like, no, thank you. Like all this kind of stuff, like to try and show they have good taste. And it's just like, but it knows it's in bad taste. It knows it's in bad taste. You have good taste, but the people who made the watch know that they've made a watch in bad taste like that. And that's okay. It's okay to make something that's in bad taste. That can still be cool. You know, like,
oh, no, but if
you dress up in like skinny black jeans and like YSL boots and a black leather jacket and a band t-shirt, that's kind of in bad taste, but it's still cool. Things can be in bad taste and still cool. You know, like you can have something that's sleazy, but still cool.
I think the issue with the Royal Oak is the Royal Pop is the
it looks shit.
It's a shit build. It's a disposable. You know, it's a fully disposable watch. The movement in it is the System 51 movement. Which
every
is
watch is disposable.
Well, but this is
I could destroy an AP. I could destroy a JLC.
But the issue with the System 51 movement is that it's a sealed movement with a single pin connecting it. It cannot be serviced. Once it's built, it cannot be reopened. Also, 51 stands for 51 parts that are built by a machine. It's like production line machine. There is like zero level of horology in this. It is off the shelf, fucking production line, automated made, cannot be serviced, cannot be opened. Once it stops. It is a true version of a disposable watch.
To be fair, what's the RRP?
£330, I think.
So, you know, it's not that crazy.
But the aftermarket,
the aftermarket, like if you buy the aftermarket, you're a fucking idiot. Like that's on you.
This is my point.
The disposability of it when it's £300 is fine.
But my point is that the market itself is the issue, because people are camping out for days to get this £300 watch, which is a poorly built watch.
Yeah, because they're
one
dummies.
That they can never service, one that is fully disposable, one that doesn't look good, but it is in the Royal Oak shape, and they're so obsessed with being able to have anything that is remotely connected to AP.
But then your beef is with them, not with the Royal Park.
Yeah, yeah, but it's easier to say I hate the Royal Oak. I also dislike the watch.
I dislike it as well. It's not. Let's be clear. It's not a regular watch, right? It's a fob.
So it's on a lanyard, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've seen people have 3D printed, and this is how desperate it gets. People have 3D printed the rest of the watch in the Royal Oak, like basically the bracelet, but in plastic to clip in. I've seen that on TikTok or Instagram. I don't have TikTok. I'm 35.
That's like people buying, you know, when people will take, you know, they'll take like the Prada little metal triangle off an old bag or something and put it on a penny loafer or something. You're like, just, that's fucking embarrassing, man. Yeah. Like, you're showing your ass by doing that.
So my biggest issue is that the watch is, whether they know it or not, as it being a trashy watch is fine, is the craze, the hype that came with it for a notably bad watch that is very disposable and you cannot service it. Like, it's probably got, I don't know, a quarter of the amount of parts to an actual decent watch build. Probably an eighth if you go like a complex chronograph build. There's nothing notable about this watch at all, other than the fact that it has AP's branding on it and it's in the shape of the Royal Oak face in that hexagonal shape. It's literally like a £5 watch and people are queuing for days to try and get one. Resale going for four figures. It, for me, it just represents everything awful about the watch market. And I guess designer stuff in general, but like, they only want to buy the label and they care nothing about the actual product. It's just about label, and it's all for show. And as an item individually, it looks like shit.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't disagree with that. I think it does look like shit. I think it's stupid and tacky, and I wouldn't buy it. I also don't really care. Like, it's just like, you know, fine, whatever. And I think it's funny how like activated people have been about it.
I don't like it. I'm quite activated by it.
Yeah, but I think a lot of that is just like, I don't like these shitheads getting involved in the watch game, and watches should be made the way that I like them to be made. And actually, it's fine for a bunch of shitty watches to be made in other ways, and it's fine for dickheads to get in the watch game. You know, dickheads have always been in the watch game. Look at every single person who owns a Rolex. Like 99% of them are silly twats. It doesn't mean Rolex sucks, but you know what I mean. Like, there are all these guys who are like flashing their watches on Instagram, and they're all fuckwits. Oh, I'm so tasteful wearing my diver. Shut the fuck up.
I dislike Richard Mille's as well. Like, there are watches I don't like that are super expensive. Like, but they just look grotesque.
So there's that's also again about good taste versus bad taste. No, like the watches that you like are more of the understated classic heritagey stuff. So JLCs, Patek Philippe's.
At least for the RMs, there's more of a build quality.
You know, even some of the IWCs, you know, like whatever. Like, it's just like, these are like regular watches that don't make you look like a flash twat. Or the watches that do make you look like a flash twat, they're bad taste. They're bad taste.
The RMs at least have some horological significance. I
think that all this stuff...
And also their price so high that it kind of cuts out that bottom end of like try hardness.
I agree that all the kind of like crazy drops are annoying. Like... I've got a Moonswatch. I've got the Moonswatch Jupiter. I was never gonna queue for it.
No.
I just waited like a year or something, and I just walked into the Swatch shop every time I walked past the Swatch shop, I went in and said, "Do you have the Jupiter?" And one day I walked in, they were like, "Yeah." Yeah. And I was like, "Great, it's like 200 quid." And I bought it. And I put it on a good strap, because the strap they supply it with is dog shit. And I like it. It's a really fun knockabout watch. It's incredibly light, it's waterproof. Like, it's basically a watch you can have when you have young children. It's good.
It's also a sealed watch. Yeah,
but they're like, but you know, it's 200 quid. Like, it just doesn't matter to me. So those sorts
and
of things.
And it's an actual watch. You wear it on your wrist.
Yeah,
it's not a little
hand. And also, when it breaks, I won't care. I'll be like, okay, bit sad, goodbye. Like, you cost me 200
pounds. Also, you're calling it a Moonswatch. You're not mentioning Omega at all. Whereas,
oh yeah, I don't care.
Whereas I feel the Royal Pop would be like, oh my god, my AP, like my AP Royal Pop.
Yeah, but what are they going to do? Pull it out of the pocket of their
waistcoat? No, what
like,
I mean
it's
is
a
like
fucking
the
fob.
The reason they're buying it is because of AP. Whereas the reason you bought the Moonswatch is because
I know,
you
but
like,
someone said
like
I'm just going to check the time on my AP, and they pulled out the Royal Pop, like pulled it out like Mr. Monopoly, and like looked at it. I'd say like, why is that fucking pink?
I picture them wearing it as like, you know, nurses' watches. On their little pocket and just like tilting it up.
Okay. Would you like the Royal Pop more if basically nurses were buying it and wearing it on their outfit? Because I would love that. That would be sick. But you know, I find a load of this stuff boring. Like, similarly, there are a bunch of guys who think of themselves as having good taste. And what is it about Americans and fucking Snoopy, Peanuts, like all that shit?
Yeah, I never got that.
They honestly get such hard-ons for Snoopy. Like, fuck Snoopy.
Yeah.
Every now and then, you know, a brand will put Snoopy on a watch, and every American, you know, fucking loses their mind for it.
I think John Mayer has an insanely expensive Snoopy Omega.
What the
I
fuck is
wrong?
What is the big deal with Snoopy? Like, I anyway, when everybody goes nuts and like queues up and everything, like it does feel a bit silly. But then I think the beef is with those people rather than the thing itself. And I kind of think it's funny to do the thing itself. Okay, what am I taking out of the burn book? I'll do a few TV shows I'm watching at the moment. Rivals is back for another series, which is very fun. We enjoy it. The Pit, we're in the middle of season two.
Oh, so good.
It's great. It's so good. It should be repetitive, you know, because every episode is so like focused on realism, right?
Yeah.
You literally watch people get intubated and, you know, sedated and given painkillers 50 times an episode.
Yeah.
And yet it's still kind of electrifying. It's great.
So just on The Pit before we move on, there's two episodes in the first season where the incident happens and it goes across 2 hours.
Yeah.
Those are two of the best TV episodes I've seen basically probably since I watched Band of Brothers when Bonnie was born.
Wow. I mean, it's very good. It's not Band of Brothers.
The best since.
No, I get that. I'm just saying that like it's not
It's not on that level. Specifically those two episodes, and if you watch season one, you'll know what two episodes I'm talking about. But as somebody who floats between the big screen and my phone screen, a reasonable amount during programs, I watch those two back to back with Jess, and I don't think I touched my phone once, which for me is astronomical, an incredible achievement.
It cured your ADHD.
Sorry, I think the pit's fantastic.
Yeah, it's not like a perfect show. Like it is great. I do find it to be quite heavy-handed in its writing at times. However, it is great. And there are a couple of performances in it I don't love.
Who do you not love?
I don't like the really, really hot girl.
The Indian one?
Yeah. Supriya Ganesh. So she is interesting, right? Because she is like a qualified doctor. Like I think she was working as a tutor, like a American. Yeah, like she was tutoring med students to pass, you know, the medical aptitude test, I think, while shooting season one.
Interesting.
But I find her performance annoying, and I find that character annoying as well. Like there are loads of scenes where someone will say, "Hey, you're a really good doctor," and she goes, "I am." Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, Americans love this shit where people are like, you know, we never admit that we're really good at things. I'm like, that's all Americans do.
Yeah.
That's all America. All Americans do is say, I'm actually really good at this thing. And you're like, all Americans think they're really good at a thing.
Yeah.
And none of them are good at anything. But like, it's just always shit talking to Americans on here. Literally zero problem with Americans. But you know, she annoys me. I don't like her performance at all. I think you can tell she was new to acting.
Sure.
There's always a performance in an episode where I'm like, oh God, just hurry up and fucking die. There's a woman in an episode we're watching at the moment where I'm like, I cannot wait for this fucker to die. Because she's giving like such an annoying, like, I'm sick performance, but I can't really say
I know the same one. Is it...
The mum.
Yeah. We're up to date, actually. Yeah, we might have one episode more to watch that might be released now.
Yeah. There's a lot of that kind of stuff. Like, sometimes
that,
you're just
that,
like...
That narrative dragged on for, like, four episodes.
I know. And with that one, I'm like, oh, okay. Like, this will do. But these are, like, minor quibbles. Like, it is a fucking fantastic show. It's really fucking good. The other show I'm watching is For All Mankind on Apple TV. So I remember starting it years ago and then kind of never really got into it. And I actually made an effort to get into it a couple of months ago. So this is the alternative history of the space race. So in this version, the US doesn't touch down on the moon with Apollo 11 for some reason. And then the Russians land on the moon first and they land a woman on the moon.
Okay.
So suddenly the US is like, fuck, we need to train like female astronauts. So they do that. And then they're like, right, we've got to be the first to establish a base on the moon. And we've got to try and be the first to go to Mars. And every season jumps forward by pretty much like a generation. So the first season, I think, is, you know, late 60s into the early 70s. And then you go forward into the 80s. And then you go forward into the mid 90s. Then you go forward into the 2000s. And that's kind of where I am now. And then I think there are a couple more seasons that are going into like 2010s, 2020s. So it's like... It starts as this very interesting, like, historical document, basically, where there are real people in it. Like, John Glenn is in it, or, like, Werner von Braun is in it, or Sally Ride is in it. So, like, people who are real people with a real, like, history in the space race.
Mm.
And then as time goes on, obviously, it's, like, constructing its own reality. Again, I think it's, like, it's nowhere near the level of, like, The Pit. It's a good show. It's not a great show. But I really, really enjoy it. If you like space as well, it's fucking sick. So yeah, recommend. Those are the good things at the moment. What are you taking out of the burn book?
What I'm taking out of the burn book are Pro Club tees.
Pro Club
the brand.
Tees.
T-shirt. Okay. The product. I have a fairly extensive collection of like single colored basic tees. Mostly white, but like I basically wear them most days. I think it's easy and simple, and like I feel that other parts of my wardrobe are more interesting, so I've just kind of demoted the tee to basically like almost an underlayer. I guess it becomes a top layer if it's too warm to layer, but I have a large requirement for like staple and repeatable, like everyday white t-shirts that are affordable but good quality. You can wear them lots, but like you also don't cry about them if they get stained or need retired, but they're not disposable in the sense that like, oh, you only get one or two good wears out of them. So it's a real kind of Goldilocks scenario to find like a good quality t-shirt that isn't expensive but is actually like good quality and is a nice cut and drapes well. And like Coles used to be my go-to. You get a box of three of them made for £55, £18 a t-shirt, perfect fit. But then they went and changed their cut last year. And now they're too baggy, the bottom's too long, so it's no longer like an optimal silhouette. And as somebody who's not overly tall, when t-shirts run too long, you start to look quite stumpy, I feel. So I looked around for like I would Google like the best white tee, GQ, best white tees, whatever, and look for their articles. And they would be putting up loads of these ones that are like 70 quid a pop for a plain white t-shirt. And to be honest, I like to buy expensive things, but I draw the line like 70, 80, 90, 100 quid for a white t-shirt because...
Agreed.
One, it's a white t-shirt. Two, I have a young child. Like, just no. I am not going to buy a 100 pound white t-shirt, which is the most sustainable item. Maybe the second most sustainable item after white trousers. So it is quite a high risk item of clothing and the likelihood that you stain it is quite high. So I was on the hunt for an affordable version of that, and Blacksmith Store have they do this big thing of premium blanks, which is basically like the same level of quality of hoodie that you would get those Represent hoodies. You know all those, like, the worst guy you knew at school now wears a Represent hoodie. I don't know if they're actually called, the brand is Represent, but it says Represent in big letters over these like big kind of heavyweight hoodies, and they do look good quality, but the premium blanks that Blacksmith sell are basically the same hoodie, just without the branding. And they're about six times cheaper because they're just they're just a basic blank hoodie. But they also sell a lot of blank t-shirts. And the Pro Club ones, 14 quid a pop. Good cut, good heavyweight t-shirt. I guess like mid to heavyweight t-shirt. Good drape. Lasts pretty well in the wash. I don't remember many that I've retired out with, like, ones that are actually stained. So they're not losing their shape. And... they, for me at least, they're like the perfect length. You can still tuck them in if you want to, but if you leave them out, they're not too long. Good length in the arms. Everything you want from it. It ticks all the boxes. 14 quid a pop. So if you have to, if one falls foul of a, I don't know, orange or red coloured snack from the baby, I'm not crying over it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's like, it's boxy, but it doesn't drown you. It's fine. Like, I think that's a fine balance if you're under 6 foot. Boxy becomes like, he'll grow into it vibes quite quickly. You know, you just look you look like a stretched out toddler. But yeah, white t-shirt, 14 quid, Pro Club, new staple, basic everyday tees.
They are really hard to get. I do think that this is an area that I struggle with too. Because you never find one that's quite perfect. And people are always like, oh, you should get the private white VC or Le Mans Saint-Michel. Like, I always look at those and think, oh yeah, those are great. They're not too long. They're not too short. The sleeves are the right length. The weight is right. And then you're like, I'm not going to pay £60.
Yeah. Everybody goes to the one that Jeremy Allen Strong wears in the Bear. And I can't remember. It's like a double barrel German name maybe. With M, and I can't remember the off the top of my head. It's like 130 quid for a t-shirt.
It's not the Mertz B. Schwanen one.
Is it? Is that it?
It's not that. Because that was obviously the one that everyone went mental for because of the bear.
No, that's what I mean. They're like Jeremy Allen White, right? White t-shirt. Yeah. They're like 100 and something quid.
I don't think they're that much. That's why I was a bit confused, because I don't think they're quite that expensive.
85. Okay.
Okay.
That's expensive for a white t-shirt. £85
that is
for a white t-shirt. Yeah, Mertz B. Schwanen. How did you pronounce it?
Mertz B. Schwanen. Mertz B. Schwanen.
Schwanen, yeah.
Schwanen.
85 quid. But that's exactly what I mean. The 215 Loop Wheel t-shirt. White. They actually have brackets, the bear, on their website in the name of this product now. But yeah, 85. I'm not paying that. 85 quid. I can get six t-shirts for a similar price. And they might not be quite as good, but they'll last a lot longer.
Okay. Well, I think those are really good shouts, man. And I think that's the end of our public episode this week. We'll catch a bunch of you over on the paid side. If you do not subscribe, please consider doing so. We'll be bringing you World Cup content and transfer news all through the summer. We'll see a bunch of you later. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.